Welcome to the History Hotline, a direct line to a better understanding of all things Black history and beyond. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lynn Cook and as always I'll be your host today. As you know, some time ago we had our first live show where I was in conversation with Dr. Jade Bentall, and today's episode will be all about that conversation. I'll be sharing clips from the live show so you can kind of hear the conversation we had, which is all about oral history and using oral history to conduct ourselves when researching Black British history and using it as a methodology. It was such a pleasure to be joined on stage by Jade and the conversation we have. If you were there, I'm sure you'll already know it was really, really fruitful. And we covered a lot of ground when it came to researching Black women, as Jade's work focuses a lot on the histories of African and Caribbean women in Britain, as well as, you know, within my work, interviewing children or the then children that are now a lot older. To conduct research on their childhood and their migration stories arriving in this country from the Caribbean. But before we get into those clips and, you know, think about some of the things we were discussing weeks ago during the live show, I do have some news. Maybe sad news, maybe happy news, maybe you're sick of me. But I will not be recording any episodes following this one. This will be the end of the History Hotline for quite a considerable period of time. I started the podcast over four years ago, August 2020, as most of you know, and it has been an incredible space to share the histories that I'm researching alongside whatever work I've been doing at the time. And it started off as something I did alongside my master's in lockdown, and then I was working as a teacher and doing it, and then I was working in a museum. And in this kind of phase in my life, I'm doing my PhD and recording these episodes and doing the research for them. And it has been quite difficult. It is really, really challenging. It's always been challenging, but doing it with the PhD and everything that a PhD entails, you know, doing research abroad, going to conferences, presenting my work, trying to write alongside of things. It's just been really, really challenging to do both. And so I'm going to pull back from the podcast. I won't say that I'm coming back anytime soon. I doubt I will come back anytime soon. But I also don't want to say this is ending forever. So it's kind of one of those where I feel really bad because I feel like I'm leaving you as listeners in limbo. But I will say there definitely won't be an episode for at least a year. If anything changes after that, then you will be the first to know. And I guess an episode or a notification from the History Hotline will pop up. I will also be taking a little break from social media as well, but I will be back there in the new year to share episodes and just kind of re-promote episodes in a sense, because I think, you know, these histories are not going anywhere. They're not going out of date. It's history at the end of the day. It's not, you know, gonna be old news. And I think they're still really important. And I'm quite interested in thinking about ways of repurposing the episodes and thinking about how they can be used in kind of shorter form content. So you might see things on TikTok and Instagram from me regarding the research I've done, whether it's from episode one of the Mangrove Nine to any of the individuals I've spoken about in the last 4 years and the moments, and even how they connect to contemporary events. You know, whilst there won't be actual podcast episodes, there will be content in some sense. And yeah, wanted to thank everybody that has supported me the last 4 years, that has listened to episodes, that has shared them, whether that be on social media or through, you know, WhatsApp messages or just through word of mouth, sharing them with your colleagues, your family, your friends. I am so, so grateful for those who have invited me into their workplace, into their schools. Thank you so much. It has been an honor and a pleasure to speak about something that I truly love, first and foremost, feel so passionately about and feel that is a vessel, that being Black British history and history more broadly, a vessel to really change things and to understand the world that we're living in now. The world we're living in now, as of the 7th of November 2024, where Donald Trump has been elected as president of the United States, the 47th president, and you know the challenges that will bring, considering the way in which he ran his campaign and has run the country in the past. It's going to be very trying times, but I think as long as we remember the historical examples that we have, and there are so many of people that overcame in more difficult and more trying times, those that pushed through adversities, those groups that organised at the grassroots to ensure that the change that they so desperately needed in the world became a reality. We all stand on the shoulders of giants, so let their example and their legacy push us forwards as we enter what might seem really daunting and really scary for some moving forwards politically, even in Britain, where we might think that the president of the United States or any other country doesn't impact us. But I think with so many global conflicts happening at the moment, you know, the situations that are unfolding when it comes to war across the world, it is so important that, you know, the people that are running these countries actually are held accountable and will make choices that are beneficial to us as a population of the country, but also to the world, to the climate, and to those who are, you know, in positions where they can't exercise their right to vote and get rid of governments and protest. You know, we must be the ones that can stand for them where we need to. So that's enough of that. This is the last episode, 150. I am surprised I got here, I'll be honest. We really made it. But yeah, without further ado, I'm going to launch straight in to the interview I had with Dr. Jade Bentall at the London Podcast Festival, September 15th, 2024. Now, I'd like to take this time to introduce a very special guest to the stage, Dr. Jade Bentall. So, Jade is a writer and historian from South London. She holds a DPhil in history from Merton College, University of Oxford, where her doctoral study was funded by the AHRC. Her work is situated in Black feminist thought, and her scholarship uses oral history methodologies to centre the experiences of Black women of African and Caribbean descent in Britain and their long histories of rebellion. For her doctoral scholarship on the Black Women's Movement, Jade was awarded the inaugural Diversity and Inclusion Fellowship by the North American Conference of British Studies in 2022 and the inaugural Justin Champion Fellowship in Black British History by the Institute of Historical Research in 2023. Jade's debut book, Rebel Citizen, uses oral history interviews to explore the lived experiences of Black women who migrated to Britain following the Second World War, and is forthcoming from Allen Lane. So welcome, Jade. As you heard from the bio, Jade is fantastic. And her work is so important in speaking to the experiences of Black women. I find that your work really complicates the narrative, this idea that A, it was just ex-service men coming, and B, if women came, it was potentially their wives or, you know, women that were just here as an appendage to a man, and then maybe as a nurse or a teacher in the kind of typical Windrush narratives. But I think you bringing in kind of the story also of African women coming for completely different reasons, coming from different classes and working in different roles. And, you know, from the snippets from your book I have heard, the different types of women that are often not part of this narrative, they don't fit the respectability politics that we have in the Black community. They are really disrupting that narrative. I find it incredible, and I'm really happy to have you here. We're going to have some time where me and Jade will talk. I have some of my own questions, And then we've got a chance for you guys to ask any questions that you would like. We have roving mics that will come around shortly. If you do have a question, wait for a mic to come to you and then you can have your time. You can also ask me anything about things I said earlier as well as Jade. So we both studied English literature as well. I did history as well at undergrad. And I found, and maybe similarly for you, with studying English literature, actually being able to know more about Black British history through an English degree rather than a history degree. I think race was a little bit more easy to speak about in English departments, question mark, using things like post-colonial theory and the kind of literature that comes from that. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about your experiences studying literature and how that kind of opened the door for you in Black British history.
Thank you so much. That's such a great question. I think I have to say I probably had a completely opposite experience to you. I wish I'd been able to kind of have access to studying Black British history during my degree, but that was not the case. When I did English Lit, it was very much about, you know, I don't know, Civil War literature and the Romantic period, you know. Of course, like mandatory. Shakespeare, Jane Austen. So I got to my final year, and that is the year when there was kind of an opportunity to explore kind of histories of race. So, you know, we looked at African literature, whatever that means. We looked at kind of, you know, post-colonial theory. So, you know, some of the things that you mentioned, but Black Britain didn't come up whatsoever. I mean, actually, when I'm kind of thinking with your question, I don't know that I've actually ever been formally like taught Black British history in a kind of, like classroom setting ever. Literally.
Yeah, never. I think actually the Home Office scandal, known as a Windrush scandal, actually started a lot of this education. And we both did our undergrads before that happened. And it was interesting actually kind of stepping into masters and PhD levels and seeing these modules available of like the Black presence in Britain and things like that. They actually didn't exist before. They definitely didn't exist in school. And university campuses are slowly catching up. But, you know, as we've seen in recent times, and for those of you that don't know, the University of Chichester have cut its Black history and histories of the African diaspora in Britain, their master's course. BCU have just threatened to cut the undergrad studies in black studies with Professor Kinde Andrews at the front of that, and Goldsmiths with their MA in Black Literature and the Black British History Masters as well. There was threatened. I think the History Masters has survived. The Queer History Masters did not. So you can see, even though all these kind of things have been put in place post-scandal, post-2020 moment, a lot of them are now being taken away and the kind of rug's being pulled out beneath our feet. I wondered how you got into thinking about Black women and then, you know, if there was such a lack of history when you studied, how'd you get here? Like, how are you now, the Oxford grad, thinking about Black women all the time?
So in my final year of university, that was also the year that the Black Cultural Archives actually opened in Brixton, and their first exhibition was about Black women in Britain. You know, so I went along. I don't think I'd even heard the phrase Black women in Britain like as a thing before. I'd kind of the year before, you know, kind of imbibed everything that I could find about kind of like Black feminism, obviously mostly rooted in the US. It hadn't even occurred to me that there could have been this like sprawling Black feminist like movement and history in this country. So, you know, I went along to this exhibition and was just, you know, just my head was blown. I eventually got to, I guess, the section that was looking at the Black women's movement. And again, I was just like, oh my God, you know, I grew up in South London. Brixton was on my doorstep, and there was this whole kind of like rich tapestry of Black feminist history, like quite literally on my doorstep. So yeah, that's how the kind of interest in specifically Black women's history was piqued. And then I guess the second thing I would say is that kind of very much like you, I was very moved when you were talking about, you know, your kind of, I guess, this maternal genealogy that you've got, you know, starting with your grandmother. You know, my grandmother was the most important person in my life. She always will be. And I'd very much kind of grown up on her stories of migration to Britain from Ghana in 1959. So, you know, kind of learning both about, I guess, this more formal movement of Black women in this country, but also, I guess, from my grandmother and, you know, her peers, this kind of more, I guess I would say, underground, kind of informal, radical history of Black women, everyday Black women in particular, was really important to me, especially women who are not regarded as, you know, quote unquote, exceptional. Within dominant historical narratives, I wanted to kind of capture the stories of just, you know, the ordinary, everyday, where just incredible things happen all the time.
That really does speak to my work, because, you know, children aren't necessarily seen as you said, exceptional, but their stories are so important, and they make up and complicate, for want of a better word, I keep using it, but it's the best word that there is, this narrative of migration, because a lot of people are migrating for a lot of different reasons and have, you know, their own personal histories behind that. What have been some of the ordinary but interesting things you've found, you know, you've uncovered within either your, you know, work for the book or for your PhD?
Yeah, gosh.
That's a really specific on-the-spot question.
Where do I start? I guess I'll go with the book, because the book is such a personal, you know, project for me. I started, you know, a series of kind of like recorded conversations with my grandmother in 2019. Just, you know, by then I'd done an oral history of the Black women's movement, where I had interviewed, you know, Black women activists involved in the movement, and I kind of wanted to apply, you know, what I'd learned to, I guess, a more kind of familial, communal history, in a sense. So yeah, I started speaking to my grandma, and like I said, you know, my grandma and I were extremely close. I thought I knew everything about her. And, you know, I asked her the first question, you know, having put the recorder down, I asked her the first question, and what she came out with was just, I was like, what? Like, you know, I did not know any of this. She was talking about, because she was born in Congo, which I did know, but she was talking about migrating from Congo to Ghana, where her family are from, during the Second World War. So she like narrated this whole experience, and I was like, you know, where did this come from? So having had that first conversation, I decided that, you know, I wanted to continue like speaking to her, and then eventually recording conversations with other Black women who had come between the kind of late 1940s to early 1980s, I guess the book spans. There's just, oh my gosh, people have had lives. It's the best way to put it. People have lived incredible lives. You know, with my grandma, I didn't know this, but she came to Britain. One of the reasons she came to Britain, you know, alongside all of these kind of, you know, other reasons that people in the so-called Commonwealth came to Britain during that time, she was also fleeing an abusive marriage in Ghana, which I didn't know about. You know, you have women in the book who were involved in sex work, you have women who were involved in drag, you have women who came as children and also found that estrangement within their families, especially, I guess, the kind of differential treatment between children born in England and children born in the Caribbean or Africa. So yeah, I think with those narratives, what I was really finding is that, like you said, there's a kind of sheen of respectability that has kind of glossed over so much of kind of Black history, but specifically Black women's history in this country. And specifically, I think when we're thinking about gender and sexuality as well, I think so much of that kind of falls out of the kind of, I guess, mainstream gaze. So that was what was really important to me, kind of asking questions that might not necessarily be asked in a more kind of institutional, upstanding history.
Did you ever, and I wonder just because of some of the things I was thinking about earlier, would you be able to find these stories in an archive? Not necessarily specifically the ones, you know, you've uncovered, but are there places that are documenting these histories of women?
That's a really good question. Not that I have found personally. You know, the Black Culture Archives has a really extensive history of the Black women's movement, which has been, you know, it's been integral to my own research. I think that's probably the biggest oral history project of Black women that I've seen. And again, it's within a very specific narrative. It's a more kind of formalized understanding, I guess, of activism. So, you know, I mean, women like my grandma, I definitely was the first person to interview her. And for a lot of people, actually, what often comes up, you know, I was speaking to one woman and she was talking about her experience of sex work, of moving to London and just trying to survive. And she was saying, I haven't even told my daughter this, you know? So I think it's both certain questions haven't been asked, but also, you know, everything has its own time. So sometimes people are ready to speak when they're ready to speak, I guess.
Absolutely. I found that a lot within these interviews with children as well, because I think the work that documentaries that have come out about educationally subnormal schools and, like, you know, racism within education, one of my participants, she kind of said when we were going through her interview and she started talking about school, she said, oh, actually, you know what? I kind of realised, like, a few months ago that I actually was put in the ESN school. She was like, I didn't know till I watched that documentary and realised that was exactly what was done to me. She said, essentially described, like, instead of being in lessons, she was taken to the dining hall. There was a group of them, and they were just given, like, toys to play with. She's about 15 at this time. Instead of doing any kind of GCSE or qualification, the equivalent, they just played with toys. They were kind of written off from they were about 12 years old. And so about the last 3 years of her education, she didn't learn anything, shall we say. And it wasn't until a teacher came and I can't remember the name of the teacher, from Barbados, came to take on this class and was kind of like, what have you been doing for the last 3 years? And they were like, we've been playing, you know, it's what they've been telling us to do. And actually helped them to kind of apply themselves and get into kind of like educational courses. And I say all that to say, a lot of the people I've interviewed, you know, like the Levi Roots, is they've gone on to extreme levels of success. And I feel like they only speak to me because they can say, despite what happened to me in education, despite this tumultuous childhood, I did well. And I wonder about the people that didn't do so well, that didn't end up with a reggae source or, you know, a career in the RAF. And I wonder if you got to speak to any of those people, and not to say anyone's, you know, life experiences are bad or anything like that, past judgment, but you get a certain type of people that's willing to do an oral history.
You definitely do get, I think there is that trend of kind of, you know, people that feel most comfortable are people that have had, you know, so-called success stories, or can, like you said, kind of point back and say, oh, okay, this really awful thing happened to me, but I've kind of overcome it. I think what has been, you know, I think important to sit with actually throughout these oral histories is that there are so many women who didn't overcome anything, you know, and that's also okay, you know, especially in the face of the kind of social conditions that they were facing. You know, I had one really poignant interview actually with a woman who came from Barbados when she was six and had a really awful time in her family and ended up going into care. She went to Shirley Oaks, which is, I think that was also documented in the kind of Steve McQueen series as well. And then kind of like Alex Wheatall came and, you know, moved to Brixton afterwards. And after moving to Brixton, she got pregnant quite quickly. She was 16. And after that, her children were taken into care. So we were talking about motherhood. And she was saying, you know, to be honest with you, I'm not proud of the way that I've mothered. You know, I can see where it came from. I can see the conditions that shaped my inability to mother, but at the same time, I'm also not proud of that. And it was kind of just sitting with that without trying to kind of resolve it or try, you know, kind of, that, you know, I think she still has a difficult relationship with her children now. So I think kind of, I guess, embracing the fact that with some of these stories, there's no neat narrative resolution necessarily, you know, sometimes things are really painful and you kind of are living with them anyway. So I think that was also part of the work of, I guess, trying to center, again, these kind of stories that are not necessarily exceptional or are not seen as, like, I guess, you know, noteworthy figures. These are, you know, everyday women who are literally trying to make a way out of no way.
Absolutely. And it adds to, you know, our understanding of Black Britain, which is our work as historians of this time and this place. You spoke a little bit about kind of this experience of recounting trauma. And I've found that with doing interviews, there is often trauma and participants can get quite upset. But they still are willing to talk through it and they want to. And there's a kind of other side of that where we finish the conversation and they'll message and say, that was such a wonderful conversation. Like, thank you for, like, giving me space to talk about this, because, you know, I don't think the average person is asking, you know, what was your childhood like moving from the Caribbean to Britain? I wondered if you had experiences like that and, you know, how people are, like, when you have to, you know, sometimes I'm assuming reaching out to strangers to say, look, I need you to tell me your stories for what will go into a book and a publication. You know, how is that?
Yeah, gosh. It can be daunting, actually, because, you know, I think you mentioned earlier, like, you are effectively a stranger who's kind of saying to someone, okay, tell me, like, you know, at times your deepest trauma, and kind of trust me to hold that with care, which is difficult, you know, it's a whole process. I think one of the things that, especially, I guess, in the early, like, stage of, like, trying to find participants and searching for people, you know, as many people that said yes also said no. So when I started oral history, it was very amateur. Like, you know, I put out a call out on Twitter and was just like, hey, it's me. You know, if you've got mothers, grandmothers, aunties, community elders, whoever, who are open to speak with me, you know, I'd absolutely love to. So, you know, you had a lot of younger people kind of approaching me saying, oh, I think, I haven't asked her yet, but I think, you know, I think my grandmother would love this. And so she would not. She would not. So, you know, I'd pop up like, hey, like, you know, do you want to talk? And then people would be like, yeah, we don't. Like, we don't want to talk. And I think it's actually been a really good lesson, as much as we're trying to kind of, I guess, uncover certain silences, there are also certain silences that need to be respected, you know? So I think that's also, you know, I'm like, okay, actually, if you're trusting me to kind of, I guess, tell this story with you, then that's great. But also, you know, for some people that have had a really difficult time and are not ready to share, and also may never be ready to share because it's their story, I think learning to just actually sit with silence has also been really, really important.
Definitely. I think you're absolutely right there, and I feel like I've had similar encounters approaching people for oral history. It does take a lot, and it also takes a lot out of the researcher. What has your kind of, if you have any kind of practices of kind of looking after yourself, you're hearing a lot of traumatic stories, you're writing them up, you're kind of in a weird way, you have to make them, like, palatable, make, you know, readable, should we say. What's that experience and process like?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I started this project in 2019, we're in 2024. It's taken some time, and a lot of people have got on to me, like, oh, where is the book?
Where is the book?
It's coming. But, like, I think, you know, in terms of, like, looking after myself, the best thing that I've been able to do is just give myself time. And I think that's also, it's not only care towards myself, which is important, but it's also care towards the stories. For people that have been through really traumatic experiences, I don't want to be someone that's also causing more harm, you know? So it's like, okay, go slow. Like, is your first kind of inclination to write this or write this in this way the best way that it can be written? Is it the most kind of ethical or caring way that it can be written? I've taken a lot of time. There was one period where I don't think I wrote one word for about 6 months. And I was just sitting with a story and kind of like turning it over in my head and just trying to figure out like what the best way through was, I guess. So yeah, I think just taking time and kind of pushing back against the kind of, I guess, demand to kind of rush things out, I think is probably the most important thing.
Absolutely. We both kind of started talking about our grandmothers, and not everybody in the room or listening is someone that has an institution behind them or is in academic study or writing a book. And I wanted to kind of speak to the idea of capturing these stories even within your families. They don't have to be published and sent out or, you know, used, but it's so nice, I think, to have those recordings, and I try and give back the recordings to the participants so that they can have that with their family to kind of use and listen to if that interests them. But do you have any kind of advice for the average person that wants to kind of chart a family history, have something to pass down? You know, none of us are going to be here forever, which is probably a good thing. Any tips?
Yeah, I think, you know, for the rest of my life, the kind of most important oral histories that I will have ever done were with my grandma. My grandma passed away last April. So I remember, you know, in the weeks after she passed, it was kind of listening to all of those recordings. I had so many. I think I have over 30, you know, of her, just like being able to listen to her voice, being able to listen to her story, has just been such a huge comfort. So yeah, I would say it's kind of as simple as that. Like literally, when I started the recordings with my grandma, it was just with my iPhone, you know, just literally pulling up voice memos, sitting with her, just having a very kind of normal conversation and just seeing what kind of came out of those. And I think, yeah, anyone can do that. So I would implore everyone, if you can and you have someone in your life that you want to speak to and you want to ask them questions about their story, like, please do it. It you know, once that person's gone, you just can't get it back.
And so that brings us to the end of our final episode for now. For the foreseeable future, I just wanted to say thank you again so much for tuning into these episodes from 1 to 150, from 2020 to 2024. I wanted to thank Zakia, I wanted to thank Destiny, I wanted to thank Wayland for all your help on this podcast at various stages and through various times. This podcast wouldn't be here without you guys, and it definitely wouldn't be here without you listeners tuning in every week, you know, supporting the podcast, making donations, sharing with a friend, and yeah, just really spurring the show on. So thank you all so much. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a wonderful week, a wonderful month, a wonderful year, and I will be back one day. Goodbye.